Welcome to another edition of Children of Song, the podcast that explores what it must have been like to grow up surrounded by music. For those of you who might be taking this journey with us for the first time, we're speaking with artists for whom making music is as natural as breathing. Some of them are the sons and daughters of music stars. Some of them grew up in homes surrounded by family music makers. Some of them began making music when they were so young that they can hardly remember a time when music wasn't in their lives. But all of them are children of song. We'll find out what inspired them, who they might have met in their travels, or stopped by their house on the weekends, and ultimately, we'll learn what drove these artists to continue the family legacy and pursue their own musical journeys. I'm Robert K. Orman, and I'm joined by my producer, Brad Newman. Hey, Brad.
Hey, Robert.
Welcome back to Music City, pal.
Oh, I'm loving this city. And I got to tell you, we've got some fun guests with us today, a father-son team. And I think today's story, what will really come out of this is the power of following your dream, following it all the way to the end of the road, and great things can happen.
Brad's here to help keep us honest and help me along the journey, and Jamie Pfeffer's here to make it all sound good as our engineer. In what we've been calling our Nashville Sessions, we're coming to you from a Midtown office that is the headquarters for two of the city's finest singer-songwriters, who just so happen to be a father and son. Marcus Hummon has been a recording artist for many labels with 10 albums and counting. In addition to being a great singer, he's also the songwriter behind such giant hits as Alabama's The Cheap Seats, Sarah Evans's Born to Fly, The Dixie Chicks' Cowboy Take Me Away and Ready to Run, Wynonna's Only Love, Tim McGraw's One of These Days, and many more. In 2005, Bless the Broken Road, as sung by Rascal Flatts, earned Marcus Hummon a Grammy Award for Best Country Song. His son, Levi Hummon, has recently become one of country music's most promising young artists. Levi co-wrote rocker Steven Tyler's single, Red, White, and You, which became a number one hit in Europe. His Guts and Glory single became the theme song for Ram Trucks, which became a tour sponsor. And since then, he's been making waves with his new tune, Don't Waste the Night. Rolling Stone calls him an artist to watch, and I couldn't agree more. Welcome, you guys.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Marcus, you have the most interesting childhood of anybody I know. I mean, Africa, Italy, the Philippines, Saudi Arabia. I mean, How do you think growing up around the world informed your approach as a musician?
That's your basic country music upbringing. You can imagine when I was in radio tours and people say like, oh, where'd you grow up? And it'd be Saudi Arabia. It turned into Virginia pretty quickly. I think there's just a lot of variety growing up. Music was always a big part of our family because my parents were musicians, not professionally, but they both played piano and they loved music, and they had a lot of variety. It was classical music, it was Broadway music. They were really, really folkies, you know. And then early on in my life, we were living in Africa, East and then West Africa, and so early stuff that I heard was really percussive, and it was just very groovy, you know, kind of African folk, what we now call reggae. We used to call high life when I was a kid.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of that. And then my sister, you know, I have three sisters. My oldest sister was really hip, and I would never forget, I mean, literally never forget the day when we wanted to hear new music, we had to send away to Sears catalog, you know, because it was, you know, 1972 and we were in Lagos. And I'll never forget, she got Carole King Tapestry. It came in the mail, right? And these three records, it was Harvest, you know, Carole King Tapestry, and Teeth of the Tillamen. And
A Cat Stevens, great record.
And I sat down and listened to those records till I was mad for it, especially Cat Stevens in a way, early on.
That's what lit the spark? Those
I do. You know, in a way, you know, it's a spark that, it's, I think it's a little like what, when I talk about watching Levi emerge as a musician, as an artist, I think one of the things that we have in common is that it was never a straight line. It wasn't a straight line for me, you know. What I found musically was a lot of passion, and then I would kind of move out and be focused on sports and girls and academics or whatever. But every time that I dropped into music, I was like dropping into a pit. Just, it was deep, and it was a heavy thing. And so in the back of my mind, even though I didn't really realize I'd do music till probably my sophomore year in college, there was always a place in my mind.
Which was the same year for me as well.
Which is the same year for Levi, yeah, yeah. Actually.
I want to clarify one thing just for our audience, because I don't think they realize that your father, why you were in all these countries.
Yeah, yeah.
He actually worked for the State Department.
That's right.
And I think also the idea of being exposed to all those cultures, but he was doing some pretty amazing things, right? I mean, he was helping economic development in these countries.
That's right.
That had to also kind of seep in a little bit with the great music, this idea of, you know, doing something good for people.
Well, that's a big thing, too. It is true. Yeah, he worked for Agency for International Development, for AID, which is the sort of economic development wing of the State Department. And then during the Carter administration, he left AID and it was a political appointment, and he was he headed up the Joint Economic Commission between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, and then eventually went back to AID and worked on the Hill, and then finally finished his career in Botswana for many years, and then in Geneva at the UN. So it was a very interesting career, and I either traveled with him or later on, you know, would spend summers in Botswana and so forth. But yeah, there was the sense of my parents also, and his grandparents, they also really were about being appreciative of the culture that we were in, and that was a big part of our lives too. We were taught that we were representing our country, but in order to do that, we had to be, you know, we had to show a lot of respect and appreciation of the culture that we were in. So, you know, if we're in Saudi Arabia, for example, my mom studied Arabic, you know, which just as an example, small town gal from Michigan, you know, studying Arabic and walking around in a culture where she's not allowed to wear short sleeves, but she loved it and was really appreciative of that. And so that was that's a big part of my life.
Levi, did you feel the same way about music? You took a winding road too.
Yeah.
You were into art and other things, and was it the same kind of thing that when you did dive into music, you found it so deep that you know, the way he did it, and at the same age?
Yeah, throughout my entire life, I grew up with obviously him having musical instruments around the house and pianos and just it always being there. But I never really fell in love with like music as like my one form of artistry. I remember growing up, we didn't really like watch TV or anything like that. We kind of just roamed around the house and would pick up guitars here and there, or pick up a paper and pen and draw superheroes or something. And it was always creative. There was always a creative spirit throughout the house. But really, it was sophomore year of college, just like my dad, and I went through a breakup and grabbed a guitar and just became my medium for expression. And I felt like that was the most genuine way for me to express myself. And I kind of like, I remember almost sophomore year when I started writing super prolifically, like super fast. And I think it was because I had all this inspiration and all these memories of my father and all this lessons and learning that like existed in the back of my mind but weren't really at the forefront of who I was. And it just kind of all came rushing in at once.
Suddenly it was there.
Yeah. Suddenly it was
there.
You
didn't know it was there, but it was.
Right. And so I immediately stepped into like writing songs, and I would be writing a verse, chorus, bridge, hook, everything. And I didn't really know what that was, but I realized that it was just part of who I was just growing up in that house and hearing lyrics and melodies be created.
Right. What were your early songs like, Marcus? They weren't country. You went to L.A. first, right?
Yeah, but the truth is that was a lark. I mean, I shouldn't have gone to L.A. first. I should have come to Nashville. I mean, I didn't know, and it was a weird thing that somebody I played football with in college knew somebody who knew Paul Anka, who heard some music. Yeah, it's a funny story. So often it's kind of awful, but it's a great story too, because you know you get hit in the mouth early on, and that's
Paul Anka invites them to LA and then never shows up,
and then we never meet him. We talked to him once, and you know he'd been sending us anyway. It's I don't want to diss poor Paul or whatever, but
wherever
I mean, it
he
was
is.
Yeah, we're in Vegas, I'm sure. But I mean, you know what I realized early on was that, you know, it was this tremendous disappointment, and then kind of hunkered down with my sister and out of college and played the clubs and you know in Santa Monica.
So
and,
when you arrived in Nashville, you knew this was the right.
Yeah, place. I knew right away. I really
Even
did.
Though you weren't country.
No, I wasn't. And in fact, one of the first guys in the company I signed with, and again, I won't say his name, but it's kind of a funny thing. And he apologized to me like 10 years later. But one of the guys that was at the company I was in, he basically called me into his office after about a month, and he said, you should leave. He said, you should go. And I always love this little story. He said to me, he goes, and he was clearly irritated by me, like really irritated. He goes, you know who you remind me of? You remind me of Dan Fogelberg. And I was like, well, okay. And he goes, that's not a compliment.
Excuse me.
He said, that's pompous son of a son, such and such. And I was like,
and by the way, Dan Fogelberg began his career in Nashville too.
Did he? I didn't know that.
Yeah, he lived in Prim Springs.
Huh. Yeah.
So there you have it.
Well, it didn't work. It didn't happen easily for me, but I loved Nashville right away because I could tell immediately that it was a town about, it was a town about music in a way that I had not experienced in living in, like I lived in South Central LA and I worked in Wilshire. This is in the mid 80s, right? And, was trying to play the clubs and it was just, I didn't have any money. I didn't have a car, it was all that kind of thing. So I got to Nashville and, within two streets, you could walk into any door. People like give you a cup of coffee. That never happened in LA. Nothing like that, right? And then immediately started playing clubs, and it was clear that the song was king.
Absolutely. First album, actually, it didn't have hits for you on it.
Yeah, that's
but
right.
But it did have hits for others, did it not?
It did, and it's kind of funny because the first single was, I began after years and years, all these record deals. I signed like four development deals, and I literally was playing so many showcases that people would ask me for questions on, who to get for lighting. And, it was just known. Well, that's the guy that showcases. He doesn't get deals, but he doesn't put records out, but he gets showcases. But I finally got signed to Columbia, yeah, because actually two of my best buddies in the business, Paul Worley and Scott Simon, briefly were kind of running that company. Mm-hmm. And then Mary Chapin Carpenter, who was also, like a real hybrid, she was reigning female vocalist of the year. So I guess they figured,
if she can make it, why not
if
you?
If she can, yeah. Anyway, they signed me, and then, of course, eventually they left the label.
And I still go to places and the radio heads and PDs were like, your dad came in here 20 years ago. I'm like, oh, God.
We still don't like him. Well, that was the thing is that I began my finally get a record out career on Columbia, right? With a disagreement with the label, was I had my first single was supposed to be a song called East Jesus USA. And it was really a song about something like a fantasy of what small town America was like. Because I just heard about it from my parents. I lived in a world of people talking about it. But I had not lived it. But I was, anyway. And so they said, they did some test marketing. God forbid you don't do test marketing. Soft research. And they found out, people were really offended.
There's no way you remember
I couldn't remember
it. Zero chance.
Wait. One day I slow down, go back to my hometown. I'm not still there, something like small towns everywhere. East Jesus, USA.
We hate you.
I hate me. I hate myself now. I'm offended.
I remember back in the day that, you'd be on the road or something, and we had All in Good Time as a CD, but all my parents' friends had it.
Uh-huh.
Or all my friends' parents had the CD. And I'd go over to there, and they would, play your songs. And I remember just being, homesick. And I was only, 5 miles away from the house, but I'd be so homesick, and you'd be gone on the road. And, I have these, recollections of hearing, Blessed Broken Road or Life is a Church and these songs from this record and being super homesick.
What was the first cut? Was it the Michael Martin Murphy thing?
There was one before it, I think Oklahoma something, Oklahoma Skies or something by Randy Van Warmer. Actually, the first actual kind of major label-y-ish type cut was that. And the first single was Pilgrims on the Way, which was Michael Martin
Murphy. That was
Michael
Martin
Murphy. I believe his last country release before he went straight cowboy.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a good song.
Thanks. Yeah. I remember, we got, Becca and I got married, and I'll never forget, it was the first time I ever heard a song. We were in Destin, of course, for our honeymoon. And we're on the beach, and they had those big speakers blaring out on the beach, and they played that song, and I just about fell out. I was just, when you've never heard, it just was amazing. It was an amazing, I could try to remember. It's a piano piece.
That's right. I've heard you do it on piano. Yeah.
Let's see. You don't know me, but I know you. We are pilgrims. We are pilgrims on the way. I could love you, you could love me, 'cause we are pilgrims. We are pilgrims on the way. Then there was some really weird chord, which is like what's happened with most of my career.
Any writing session I go in nowadays, it's like, your dad, The guy with all those chords.
He's the never a chord he didn't like.
And then, I love your dad, but he knows a lot of chords.
Didn't that first album have One of These Days on it?
Yeah, One of These Days, and it had three things that were single. Well, four things were single by other people. So Blessed Broken Road was, of course, single by a bunch of people. It had it had Jim Collins' first single, too. I'm sorry, I can't remember the title. But then it had Honky Tonk Mona Lisa,
yes,
which was
Honky
Tonk Mona Lisa. And it was a Doug Stone thing. And then
it was a single for you, too, wasn't it?
Well, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. It was, yeah. By then, it was like the long breakup. Alice just put one. Just put
it still makes records, folks. They're just not for Columbia.
Well, they did put it out, and actually, and at that point too, I'd finally asked for a video because the first one we did, you know, and actually the first song was like, it looked like there were some possibilities because what was the station in New York, YNY or whatever? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that was like our flagship. They were our big believer, and it just happened week two or three of the singles release, they folded, you know. Back in famously, you know, because they'd been around for like 35 years and they were heavily weighted station. That was a really good station to have. And right at the very beginning of the release of the single, they ceased to exist. And that hurt. That was rough.
I seem to remember, though, that when you got dumped from the major label world, that was really, it turned out to be a blessing in disguise, didn't it?
I mean, it definitely did, actually.
Because you stopped holding your songs for yourself.
That's right.
And started pitching them to others.
Yeah.
And that really changed your life.
It did. A couple things. Well, you know, I should say that prior to that, I actually, the first really great fortune I ever had happened before I had a record deal was my first number one was actually just before that. And it was Wynonna Judd's Only Love.
Oh, we have to hear that.
So, I have to, but
that's got a funny story to it too, right? I mean,
it does.
Share that a little bit. Didn't you have to run after it with some kind of cassette or something?
Well, let me see if I get this. I don't have a tuner, but do it by ear. Yeah, so it was just a period of time when, you know, not a lot had happened, and my wife and I we were at the house, and there was a phone machine, the old phone machines. And I was on one end of the shotgun house at the piano, and she was in the kitchen doing something, and you could hear, you know, the voice came out and goes, "Hi, this is Wynonna Judd, and I'm calling from Los Angeles, and don't you think it's strange that I'm in Los Angeles, and what should I be hearing but a song from Nashville?" Anyway, and it's going on. I'm like, oh, my God, and I go running to the middle of the house is where the phone thing was, and Becca comes running the other way. And it's a true story. I mean, we looked at the thing, and this person, Wynonna, or whoever was speaking, went on, and it was all like, you know, and God bless you, and all these sweet kind of things you'd think Wynonna would say, you know. And I looked at her, and I was like, pick up the phone. I was too nervous and scared, you know, because, like, what if that is Wynonna, and this is my break? You know, and she was like, I'm not picking it up, you pick it up. And you can see your mom doing that, too. And all of a sudden, it's like, and God bless. Click, and that was like the sound of the end of my career, right? Because that was it. Like, that was my moment, right? And so what I did is I went to Universal Records, I believe it was her label. I think it was Universal. And I just sat in the, I waited. She was in LA, so I went that next week. I waited. I knew that she would eventually walk in the door. She'd have to walk in the door. And I would just say, I'm the person you called. And
here it is.
And she did. She eventually walked in the door. I sat there. It says Nashville, so they give you coffee. They don't kick you out. There's no security, right? And she did walk in. I remember she came in like a big cape. It was killer. And she remembered me, and she cut that song. And then they couldn't figure the chords out, because I was using an open tuning. And so they called me to Emerald, the old Emerald studio, and they said, would you like to come in and play? And so I ended up, I'm the acoustic guitar player on that, and that was an amazing session. I mean, just the first thing to completely go right. And I was so nervous. I was like, because I didn't want to mess up the guitar, you know, because it would all be my fault if it didn't work out. I have sailed a boat or two out on the wild blue, yonder two dreams rarely come true. And as far as I can see,
on this island of green. I will put my trust in just one thing. Only love sails straight from the heart. To the other shore. Oh, and out of all the flags I've flown, one flies high and stands alone. Only love.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
Given that it was a struggle, did you, when Levi started to express an interest?
Yeah.
Did you, at some part of you, want to shield him from I mean, there's a lot of rejection.
Yeah, I still do, and yet I feel like he's doing really, really well. But because of my experiences and, you know, the almost Murphy's Law quality, I don't say almost, you know. It definitely, I'll tell you this, though, Robert, he always had it. And I don't, you know, it sounds like I'm kind of bragging on my kid, but he would pick up a guitar when he was a little boy, and he would, you know, he'd pick up a bass. At one time, we set up the basement. We had a drum kit, crappy drum set, and a bass, and electric guitar. And, like, he would just play, and sometimes he would write a song, but they were always really creative. But the big thing was he could sing. I mean, he could just always naturally sing, and he would make things his own in a way that I know as... For me, as a singer, like I sing all the time now, and have for many, many years, and I love it. And I love the voicing and just the world of being a singer. But when I was growing up with guitars and piano and learning, I did a lot of singing into my shirt. You know, that kind of like just real quietly, breathy, that thing, which, you know, it's really no good for anybody. And I eventually had some people that told me, you know, taught me to not do that. But Levi would do it as a child. He
did
would
you take advice
there,
well, so. Levi? Or did you ask for advice, I guess would be the
I didn't really ask for advice so much as I would come to my dad with a song sometimes, and I'd be like, what do you think of this? And that still to this day happens every day. Like, I'm at the house and I have a guitar on me. I'll be playing something new and ask him, like, what do you think of this verse, mm-hmm. chorus? I'm bringing this to a co-write. And he always gives me his honest opinion, which is nice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's... I remember back in the day, he would really, really championed me being a songwriter, and I didn't really understand what that meant, but we would actually occasionally go into the studio and record just a couple things, mm-hmm. here and there when he was doing a session, like over at the old Studio 19 and a few others,
mm-hmm.
and I would get in there, and I was way under, like, not ready to do it yet, but I got to kind of experience it, like, hear my voice back to me for the first time, and be like, oh, God, I hate this so much.
Everybody does.
Yeah, and now, I mean, like, as I've developed and more stuff's happened, and the songs have gotten better, I really do feel like I did have a lot of advice that I didn't even really know about growing up.
What's an example of a song where you first sort of got it, where you first really felt you had something?
There was a bunch of songs that really started, like, it was like this, like, building blocks. But really the one song that we wrote together kind of really kicked it off for me as an artist. And it was the first time I listened back to a song, and I was like, this really defines me as a person, and it also defines my family. And my mom's a preacher here in Nashville, mm-hmm. and she started a thing called Thistle Farms, which helps women with a history of drug abuse and sex trafficking get off the streets, and it's amazing. Their products are at Whole Foods and a bunch of different places. But we wrote this song about taking all the wrongs and the pain in the world and turning it into love. And my mom preaches that love is the most powerful force for change in the world. And
you know what I like about her sermons? They're short.
Yeah, she's short, sweet, and to the point. Yeah. So, yeah. Me and my dad and the late, great Andrew Dorff wrote this together. And I usually dedicate this song to Andrew Dorff whenever I play it, so.
He just died not long ago.
Okay.
Here's Make It Love.
Take the tears and the careless words. Take the fears and all the hurt, and let's just make it love, and let's just make it love. Oh,
take the rain that's been falling down, and take this pain that's been hanging around, and let's just make it love. Take each other's hands, and let's just make it love while we both still can. And let's just make it love, make it love.
Anyway, something like that.
So nice.
I'm Robert K. Orman, and you're listening to Children of Song, and our guests today are Levi Hummon and Marcus Hummon, both of whom write songs here in Music City. Marcus, you're kind of famous for going to the artist and collaborating with the artist. And I'm thinking particularly of the Dixie Chicks, who a lot of the Nashville songwriters go on pilgrimages down there to Texas to hang. And what's it like to write with them?
It was great. I mean, it's really been quite a while. They were just in town. Finally, of course, they just got back together and did a world tour, and I'm so happy for them. And happy for all of us, you know, who had songs, and to have those songs live again is really great. They're very creative. They were, you know, to me,
Marty and Emily are really good players.
They're very good players, and Natalie's as good a singer as I've ever come into contact with. She's as good as instinctive a... and you know, she's a passionate, she's just a remarkable singer, but there's a special combination in those women that, you know, it's not completely a surprise if you think of it. It's the biggest selling female group in history.
Tell me about Cowboy Take Me Away.
Yeah, Cowboy
who came up with it?
Well, that's another one of those stories that it's just, I was, you know, the first time I wrote with Marty, we actually wrote what ended up being the first single on Fly. So I wrote with her the first or couple weeks of the first single on the first album was a song that Costas wrote called I Can Make You, or I Can Love You Better Than That, right? Mm-hmm. So then I was leaving Columbia, they were coming in, but we had the same, Scott Simon was their lawyer and Paul Worley. So I had my friends attached, and they were Roots babies, and that's what I did. It just didn't work for me, and so I got to write with them. That's why I got to write. So we wrote Ready to Run. I didn't know. I did the demo. I didn't know if anything would happen with it. I never even heard from them about it, right? But I got a call to write with them again, and by that time they'd sold about 5 million records, right. You know, and the cat was out of the bag, right? So I remember going and
when's the next flight?
And by then, you know, the first time I wrote with her, I met her at a coffee shop. Second time I wrote with her, I had to drive out of town. I had to go through security. They each had like their own cabins, and there was a farm there. Took Levi, yeah. And the thing that I remember was we wrote a song, and it was not a very good song. And I knew that it was like 2 o'clock, and that 3 o'clock Gary Burr was coming. You know, because Gary's one of the greatest writers of that era.
He's really good.
He's really good, and it was really making me mad. You know, because I ruined. Yeah, I blew it. I had this big chance. And so she was actually making me SpaghettiOs. She was asking if I want spaghetti. It was really sweet, and she was making them for lunch. And she said, "What I really wanted to do was write this title that, you know, that we didn't get to, but yeah, you know, would you like to hear it anyway?" And of course, I was very excited. You know, oh my God, you know. She said, "I want to write it for a wedding." And then I thought, I'm going to be totally inside in the family. I'm going to be like, you know. And then, and she says, "Yeah, so here's the title." And this is a true story too. It sounds apocryphal, but she goes, "I'd like to. Yeah, it's Cow Gone, Take Me Away. Cow Gone. Yeah."
Which was an ad slogan.
Which a famous ad slogan. And I'm old enough, like I can, you know, that's like a lady with her leg hanging
out.
Hanging out the bath. Well, you're too young. And bubbles, you know.
Yeah.
And I was literally trying to come up, I thought maybe it's going to be this cool parody spoofy thing. And I said, well, love comes clean. And, you know, I had this whole, I had all these soap metaphors. And she finally said, no, I'm not Cowgon. Cowboy. She's marrying, Charlie's actually a cowboy. He actually has like a ranch. And she's going to marry a cowboy. So I went, just thought this would be great for her wedding. And and also the thing about that song is it's the fastest song I ever wrote, because I had just a couple of lines, just the beginning of the song, and she had this melody. She had the rolling arpeggio thing, and we just practically sang it back and forth to one another. I want to touch the earth. I want to break it in my hands.
wanna grow something wild and unruly. I wanna sleep on the hard ground in the comfort of your arms, on a pillow of blue bonnets, blanket made of stars. Oh, it sounds good to me. She said, cowboy, take me away and fly this girl as high as you can into the wild blue. Set me free, oh, I pray, closer to heaven above and closer to you, closer to you.
Very cool.
So great.
Levi, am I right? The first cut you ever had was with Aerosmith, Steven Tyler.
It is. It was like the first time I ever wrote with an artist too, so that was kind of crazy.
So how was Steven?
Oh my gosh. So my publisher is a guy named Desmond Child, and he wrote songs like Dude Looks Like a Lady and Living on a Prayer and a bunch of big old songs from
Living
the 80s.
Living La Vida Loca. I mean, he's got a catalog as long as your arm.
Yes, he is a very prolific, amazing songwriter. And he and Steven were getting together to write a song for his record, and Steven was doing this country record with Big Machine.
Mm-hmm.
And Desmond and him said they like got together and didn't write a song, and I had the song started called Red, White, and You. And Desmond played it for Steven, and Steven jumped up and down in the room, he said, and they called me on the phone, and of course I like missed the call, and it was like all this voicemail. It's like, hey, it's Desmond and Steven, and we're here chilling, and we want you to come by the studio and work on the song with us. So I like got the voicemail, and I was like worried that they had already left or whatever, and I drove as fast as I could over to Destin, and Steven was still there, and Desmond was there, and we're like, hey, what took you so long? I was like, oh my gosh. And I got there, and it was so weird because, so Steven was in that chair, and I like, and I had like only seen pictures of him like throughout my life, like on the internet or whatever.
Yeah, big lips and all
that. Yeah, and he looked exactly like he looks like in all those pictures. Mm. And I was just kind of like freaking out the whole time, and I was nervous to talk, and like I just, Dream On is one of my favorite songs of all time. Mm-hmm. And so I sit there and I'm on the console, and he's wanting to do the work tape and the demo like at the studio. And so I'm sitting there on the console, and he's like singing in the mic, and I'm on the console talking back, and I'm like kind of like guiding him through the song, and I was like, I'm guiding Steven Tyler through the song, and it's like, it was just insane. And just hearing him kind of talk was, talk about his life and talk about his stories was like enough to like a lifetime worth of rock starness.
So Red, White, and You.
Oh my gosh. Red, see if I remember it. Yeah, so we wrote this one, and it was actually made it on a Skittles commercial in the Super Bowl. It's kind of this claim to fame, and it was one of the cooler experiences. Right now, nothing else matters. It's you and me and the Georgia night. Look around, cause it don't get any better. Have you ever felt so alright? Let's dance and take it slow, yeah. Tom Petty's on the radio, and we're singing about American girls like you. When I look in your eyes, all I wanna do is bang, bang, baby, like the 4th of July. A lightning strike in the midnight sky. Don't give a damn about the summertime blues. All I need is red, white, and you. Can't let those colors fade. Tell me you're gonna stay. American girl making dreams come true. All I need is red, white, and you. Oh, oh, oh.
Add that little in your mind, that Steven Tyler shriek.
Yeah, it's just like, I'm like a whole step lower than he is on that.
Exactly.
Giant.
Your parents, Levi, are both very socially progressive people and very socially conscious people.
Yeah.
Do you find that comes naturally to you as well? I mean, do you try to also incorporate your awareness of the good and evil in the world into your work?
Yeah, I think, I mean, like for instance, I wrote a song called Guts and Glory.
That's exactly where I was going.
Yeah. So, yeah, I wrote a song called Guts and Glory. And it's just kind of me kind of talking about what America is to me. I wrote it, and Ram Trucks picked it up as their kind of go-to song. And We went on this basically cross-country tour on a Ram truck. And in Flint, Michigan, we delivered water to Flint, Michigan. In Austin, Texas, we piled food in the back of a truck and delivered it to the communities there. And we just found new ways to kind of be involved in different communities as we entered them. I wrote it with the awesome Tom Douglas and Travis Hill.
I love Tom Douglas.
I haven't played it in a minute, so this might be...
Rosa Parks on a Montgomery bus with firemen rushing in. We're standing alone, falling down and losing till we win. We're Armstrong walking on the moon, a giant leap for mankind. We're fighting with a band of brothers, never leaving one behind. Getting up, going to work, blood and sweat and tears, giving all we got till it hurts and standing all our fears.
Fears staring down our fears.
Staring down our fears, stripes and stars. It's our story, it's who we are. We are guts and glory. Oh, oh, oh. We are guts and glory.
It's a cool song.
Totally messed up, but
I like the song.
Yeah,
no, I did too.
Liked it.
Ram Trucks loved it.
Did
very
you
blessed.
Take him with you when you won your Grammy Award for Song of the Year?
Yeah. I want to tell this story. So my dad got, I think, nominated for Grammy 3 times in his career so far. And the first 2 times he took my mom and they lost. And my mom was sick of losing and she thought she was bad luck. So the 3rd time, she was like, I'm not going to L.A. again to watch you lose.
Staples Center to lose.
This was the time when Bless the Broken Road.
Yeah, this is Bless the Broken Road. And I remember we get to the Grammy and Staples Center, the place. And I'd never been to L.A., and I was, like, way into skateboarding at the time. So I had, like, my Bob Marley shirt, my white tight skater pants, and I was just rocking out, like, so ready to hang out with everybody. And in front of us was the reggae. It's like reggae, country, and then like metal is like right after one after the other in terms of the awards.
Right.
Because at the Grammys, there's like a pre-Grammys Grammys.
Right.
And so
which is where they give out the country stuff usually.
Yeah. So we, with my Bob Marley shirt on, watched the reggae people go up first and win and whatever. And Ziggy Marley was up there, and then the country music thing happened.
Remember who was sitting next to us?
And this was I'll tell that part in a minute. Okay. But so it was like me, my dad, and Jeff Hanna from the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. And we were sitting there, and my dad the whole time was saying, like, I don't care if I win. I don't care if I win. We're going to lose. Just get ready. And he was sitting there just like when it was his time, and he was just like hands were sweating, like knuckles together, white knuckles.
Clenched fists.
And they said, Country Song of the Year, God Bless the Broken Road. And my dad just stands up and says, hell yeah. Screams it out loud right in front of everybody. It was awesome.
I said hell.
Yes, you did. You did. It was like a yeah or something.
I said yeah. I said, yeah!
It was like a, it was a loud yell.
My yell.
We were sitting next to the Black Eyed Peas.
Yeah.
And they all had pure gold suits on.
Bless the Broken Road had a broken road too.
Yeah, it just went on
you
and
know
on.
The Rascal Flatts didn't want to cut it.
Yeah, I've heard all kinds of stories. I mean, I've heard so many stories, and it, you know, goes all the way back to like 92. You
Melody Crittenden had it.
Well, she had it after me. So the first recording is actually, you know, it was written with Jeff Hanna. You know, first of all, there was a guy, another guy's on the song. It was a guy who told me a story in a bar, you know, which right. Bobby Boyd, and he had this thing about his marriage and a divorce and the great possibilities of good things happen. Anyway, so that's its own little story. But I was saving up an idea for Jeff Hanna because I wanted to write. I wanted to get on the Dirt Band's record. Mm-hmm. And I had just sung at his wedding with another wonderful songwriter, Matresa Burke. We're
Jeff Hanna
friends.
Is a member of the Nitty
Jeff,
Dirt
he is,
Band.
Jeff Hanna is a member of the Dirt Band, one of my favorite bands ever. And so I brought the beginning, just a little piece of this on piano to Jeff. And we finished it, and then that I thought that was the end of it because they did cut it, although they didn't do it on piano, and Jeff didn't sing it, and Jimmy, and I mean it was all great. It's just we got the cut, and I thought, well, that's it. But I continued to play it, and then when I got a deal, I did the piano version the way it was written, cut it live in the studio. It was really fun to do it that way. And then after that, they never let that song be singled, but Melody Crittenden came and she was on Asylum, and she took it just high enough, like in the 40s?
46.
Yeah, okay, 46. So we thought, Jeff and I thought that was kind of
I didn't
it.
I know this.
Well,
a history.
Yeah, wow. It has a history. And then there was the sense, like, there's the old adage in Nashville, if somebody singles a song, if it doesn't go too high, you can give it 5 to 7 years, and then maybe you can try it again. It's just one of those things. That
doesn't happen often.
Doesn't happen often, but that is what people sometimes say. So it wasn't completely out of the possibility. I was writing at that time with Rascal Flatts, had a number of songs on their first couple of records, and wrote with Jay a fair amount, Anyway, they used to say sometimes...
Jay DeMarcus.
Jay DeMarcus, yeah. And
he's a member of Rascal Flatts.
Rascal Flatts. And he would say, man, we love that song. We love that song.
He's actually the one I trust the most musically in that group, frankly. I mean, he's the one who can produce and who is actually...
I can't speak to that because I'm still hoping to get songs cut by them. But no, Jay is... Listen, they're all really good musicians. And Jay's, you know, he's wicked good and he's a good producer. He cut a song of ours on Chicago, of all things. You know, I mean,
that
guy
right.
can...
He did produce that
He's
record.
A very good piano player, I mean, mm-hmm. as well as all the... Everything, a good drummer. Anyway, we went out of the country. We were overseas in Botswana, and I remember getting back, and it was their third album had come out, and Feels Like Today, you know, and that first single had come out, which didn't do as well as they want, and they were thinking about dropping the entire album, like just for, you know, done, and then move on and start what ended up being their next career was kind of with a different producer. They were going to trash the whole thing. And then they decided they would cut one more song.
And that was it.
And they went in and they cut it and they cut the fire out of it. And I mean, I have to say, you know, you have the songs that get cut if you're lucky enough through the years. I genuinely, when I first heard that recording, I loved that recording. It was sparse. You know, you could hear the piano, you could hear one guitar, one acoustic, the way they were vocal. And Gary's Gary. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, like Gary's one of the greatest singers
Sings
in popular
like a bird.
Music.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
I set out on a narrow way, it was many years ago, hoping I would find true love along that broken road. But I got lost a time or two, I wiped my brow, I kept pushing through. I couldn't see how every sign pointed straight to you. Every long lost dream led me to where you are. And others who broke my heart, they were like northern stars, pointing me on my way into your loving arms. And this much I know is true, that God bless the broken road that led me straight to you. I think of all them years I spent just passing through. I'd like to take that time I lost and give it back to you. But you just smile and you take my hand, 'cause you've been there and you understand that it's all part of a grander plan that is coming true. And every long lost dream led me to where you are. And others who broke my heart, they were like northern stars, pointing me on my way into your love. This much I know is true, that God bless the broken road that led me straight to you.
You know, you guys ought to think about doing this for a living.
It's fun to sing with them. I don't get to sing with them as much anymore.
Marcus Hellman and Levi Hellman, everybody, thank you guys so much.
Of course.
So much fun.
Our pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Before we let you go, we've got another song and a story. It's a bonus track we like to call the B-side, Stories from the Road. First, here's Levi with a little bit of his latest single, Don't Waste the Night. and two very different road stories from father and son, who may be a generation apart, but together in music every step of the way.
I remember writing the song. I had just learned the cover of Tracy Chapman's Fast Car, and it went something like, and I really wanted something like that, like in my set, something that was kind of fun and moving and also had that pizzicato kind of guitar playing. And so I got in a room with my buddies, Josh Thompson, who's an artist in town, and Matt Dragstrom, and we wrote this one. It's called Don't Waste a Night.
Girl, I had a call. I can't keep staring at that clock on that wall. It's easy to say, cause you know I want it all. Yeah, I want it all. Oh, yeah. Don't take your time, cause that morning's gonna shine. And I need those eyes staring into mine. Just cause you're tangled up in the sheets, don't mean we ain't gotta go to sleep. To sleep. No need for dreaming, we can make our dreams come true. Oh, let's get lost in a moment. I wanna get lost with you. Show you what's on my mind. Don't close your eyes and don't waste the night. Come on, come over. Don't waste the night. Stay up, stay over. Take that as a yes.
Don't waste the night.
Don't waste the night, baby.
Waste it.
Sound good.
Thank you.
A quick road story. Wildest thing on the wildest thing ever on the road for you.
I'll close my ears.
Or weirdest or stupidest.
I don't know. I there's so many. Gosh, I have so many memories. My mind is going to my only really great. Well, I've had a couple of fun tours, but the one really great tour early on in my career when I was on Columbia, I got to open for Alison Krauss and Union Station in Europe, and so we were playing like, you know, Gaiety Theater, Ulster Hall. We played which one's on the Thames, the Royal Festival Hall, you know. And I had one guy I could bring with me, and I brought Daryl Scott, because we were just becoming buddies, and he was living out in Mount Juliet, and he was, you know, great. And they didn't have room in the bus. They had the full, you know, everybody, Jerry, everybody, you know. And so here we were. I'd get 45 minutes, and then we would listen to one of the greatest roots groups on the planet.
Yep.
And really an American ambassador of all that is good in music. I mean, literally, it was like that. And we would sit. We'd do my set, and we would sit, and we would just, you know, just drink it in. And the other thing that I remember is that the last show was London. It was the Festival Hall. And my wife, his mom, she flew over. You know, it was such a big deal. Becca came over, and my publisher at that time, Danny Strick, actually filled the room, my dressing room, with flowers. I'll never forget it.
Wow.
You must have felt really good.
I did. And he wrote in a card, they were all for Becca. He loved Becca. Everyone loves Becca. They should. They should all love Becca. But they all do. And he sent flowers, a room full of them, for her. Isn't that great?
That's very sweet.
Part of it for me right now is like, as at the artist point I'm at, it's like sometimes you play a show and it's like the Fillmore for Kit Moore and it's sold out and amazing. And then other moments, you're in an empty pizza bar kind of playing music. And you kind of get like the juxtaposition. Everything kind of happens. But a wild tour story for me was we were in the middle of Baton Rouge. And it was some empty kind of Wild Wings bar. And we get there and they have like glass all over the floor. And it's basically a biker gang. And I step on stage and this guy's like, "Get off stage, Justin Bieber." I was like, oh, God. Anyways, by the end of the night, I actually had the entire Liger gang dancing, so it was kind of fun. I started playing Johnny Cash, and I was like, I remember it.
It all worked.
Thank you, guys. That's awesome.
Thank you so much.
Next week, a powerful episode with the singer-songwriter Jimmy Wayne. He'll talk about his incredible childhood, one that left him homeless at one point. We'll find out who saved him, how he found music, and what he's doing now to save other homeless teens. It's an emotional can't-miss episode on the next Children of Song, the podcast that combines live music with great storytelling. Till next time, I'm Brad Newman. Thanks for listening.